Hello and welcome back to Radio Verulam, where we are once again speaking to your local politicians. And I'm once again welcoming Shadow, well, he is now Shadow Immigration Minister, no longer just Shadow Home Affairs Minister, Whip and Labour MP, Bambos Charalambos, to get the answers to your questions. Remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get the answers from Bambos this time, he will be back again this month. This show is all about you getting answers to your questions. But yes, Bambos, since we last talked, there's a few things that you'll be on a high about. First of all, maybe most important to a lot of people, but your beloved Chelsea won the Champions League. How did you watch the match? How did you enjoy seeing Chelsea become champions of Europe?
Well, I watched the match around my brothers, it's obviously very nervous if you're a football fan, especially if you're a Chelsea fan. You don't expect success to come easy, especially not against Man City. But as the game wore on, and as my fingernails were sort of, you know, bit into the to the bit, then it was definitely quite tense. But yeah, very, very relieved afterwards, especially in the second half after City mounted a more and more attacks. Yeah, it was a great game, really enjoyable, very tense, and I was very much on a high afterwards.
And I guess as well, with COVID restrictions, things becoming more normal, was it even better to be able to share that moment with your family?
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's always best to, you know, share moments like that, especially if it's your football club or wherever, and somebody who can also appreciate it with you.
Yes, there's also congratulations there, as I kind of alluded to in the introduction, but there are congratulations to you personally as you've been made Shadow Immigration Minister. How happy were you to receive this news?
Well, it was quite a surprise, and I'm deeply honoured to have the confidence of, you know, that Keir's put in me to do this role. It's a very demanding role. Very, very pleased to have it, and looking forward to the challenges.
You say it was a surprise. So how are these roles kind of given to people then? Do you say that immigration is one of your areas that you're passionate about, or is it literally just chosen by the leader for the people that he thinks is best at the job?
It was just a phone call out of the blue one morning as I was waiting on the platform for the train at Palmer's Green. I knew they would, like, they've done the reshuffle for the major positions, but they hadn't done the sub-cabinet ones, or sub-shadow cabinet. So, it was just totally out of the blue. I wasn't particularly angling for a change or anything like that. It just got a phone call, and clearly I must have been doing something right.
Well, I mean, did you have to temper your celebrations as well, because you were about to get on the train, or were you able to celebrate fully? Did you call your family and tell them the good news?
No, I kind of I just got on the train, and obviously they had to make other phone calls as well, so I couldn't let anybody know, you know, just yet. So you've got to, like, keep it quiet for a little bit.
So that's interesting behind the scenes in terms of how people get these roles. Another question of behind the scenes is, what does the new role entail? How will it be different from your previous role, and will there be much more of a workload for you?
It will be very different from my old role, because this role is it's very live and very real, in that lots of things are happening that's on a daily basis that, you know, you're sometimes asked to comment on. One of the big things that's going to be happening is the EU settlement scheme. So obviously people have got until the 30th of June to register to preserve their EU citizens' rights, if they've been in the UK for 5 years prior to Brexit. So there are concerns that not everyone who is able to apply has applied, so people might lose out as a result of that, and they might therefore lose access to benefits and access to the NHS and even access to jobs and to accommodation for example. So these are serious concerns. The government also introducing a new borders bill that's coming up, so that's probably going to be introduced probably in July time, I expect, and it's going to be something that is going to try and tackle, well, the government wants to try and tackle illegal immigration, as they call it, although I think it's I think we'll do no such thing. So there's going to be quite a few challenges there coming forward.
So it will be a very busy time for you over these summer months, and we will try to keep up with your workload and give everybody the information that they need in terms of it. But let's switch the focus on to a local issue that a lot of people have messaged in wanting to know how it will affect them. Many people were worried about the recent flooding in Wood Green. Can you give us the latest on what is going to be done for businesses that have been affected by the flooding in the area?
It's Wood Green's not actually my constituency. I was aware of the flooding. I do think that the shops should be compensated if it's been through no fault of their own. Some may have insurance, so I think they should certainly look at sort of contacting their insurers about this. But I do think if it's not their fault, then there should be some sort of level of compensation. Where that comes from, I'm not sure. Usually, if it's a serious flooding, sometimes the government gives some compensation, especially if it's unforeseen. But I don't know what the specifics of this are. But I do hope the businesses do get recompense for the loss that they've suffered as a result of the flooding.
And who would you recommend for them to contact then? Because as you said, this is not really your area of locale.
I think the local MP would be Catherine West. So I think they should contact Catherine West or the council, because I'm sure Harrogate Council will have had a number of complaints about this, and I'm sure they'll have had a plan in place to deal with people's concerns and claims. Or if they haven't, then they'll be able to signpost people to the appropriate place.
So moving on to from a local issue to party issues, the latest YouGov poll has come out showing that amongst Labour voters, it's believed that the party is more divided than united. Indeed, it's now believed by 56% of people in the party that it is divided, and only 12% say that it's united. What is Sir Keir Starmer going to do about this?
Well, I think, don't forget, I mean, Keir Starmer has only been the leader for the last year, and he's been the leader during the pandemic when everyone's focus has been elsewhere. So I think now that hopefully we will be coming out of lockdown in the not too distant future and restrictions will be lifted, then we can actually have more discussion, more debate about policies and direction that the Labour Party will be taking. So I think there still is, I think Keir's not been able to get his message out as much as he would like to have got it out because of COVID. And also people are, you know, parties that have been in power, the ruling parties, wherever there's been the COVID outbreak, have always seemed to be doing well, because people look to them to give leadership at a time of crisis. And that's why opposition parties all around Europe, across the world, don't do as well in times of crisis. But I do think once COVID is out of the way, then you will see Labour doing far, far better.
What would you say, though, that the Labour Party's core ideas are moving forward? You said that it's not been communicated too well to the public. It's a month on from the election, and when I talked to you last month, you said that you're going to be working on these core ideologies. So can you add anything that we can kind of say to our listeners that this is what Labour stand for going forward?
Well, obviously, we believe in fairness. So we believe that people should be treated fairly. They should have access to opportunities that are denied them. We also believe in making sure that public services are protected. And we also believe in people being secure and safe in their environment. So these are some of the areas that, you know, we're very keen on, very concerned about the future prospects for young people. Furlough is still in place at the moment. Young people have been disproportionately affected by job losses as a result of COVID. So we're very concerned about what's going to be put in place for young people. So there are lots of things that we're going to be focusing on. The we're still at least a couple of years away from an election, and I think you'll see our policies being firmed up as we get closer to the time. But the Labour's always been about sort of speaking up for people about fairness, about equality, about justice, and those causes that we're going to be pushing forward, I'm sure.
One of the core ideas for Labour for a long while has been the nationalisation of the train service. Does it annoy you, or does it make you happy that the Conservatives have almost gone with one of your core ideas that has been there for a long old while? I mean, are you happy that it has been instigated, but not by yourself, or would you have liked to have done it yourself?
Well, obviously, I'd have liked to have seen a Labour government sort of be renationalising the railways. But a good idea is a good idea, and it doesn't matter who does it. If it's a good idea, it's a good idea. And I do think that that shows that it was such a good idea that the government now adopting it. So clearly they recognise that in our manifesto from 2017 and 2019 that we should be going down this path. We should certainly be doing it, because if you've got a franchise, then you have a monopoly on running a train up and down a track, and you're going to be able to, basically it's a license to print money. And I don't know when Stagecoach lost the contract to run the East Coast Main Line and it was brought back in-house, it was proved to be a great success. So I think that's the good blueprint for the future.
Let's move on to your conduct within the House of Commons. And this month you asked the important question, as you've alluded to there with your immigration work, for assurances that those entitled to settled status won't lose their rights or be detained if they miss the deadline. Do you believe that these rights have been protected to a fair level? Are the government doing enough?
Well, they will say they have done, but the problem is it's the people who... you have to make an application for settled status online. So you have to have access to the internet to be able to make the application. So if you're an elderly person who's been in the UK for many, many years, but you may not be very digitally savvy, you may miss out, even though you have all the right sort of criteria to qualify. And that could have quite devastating effects. We've seen what happened with the Windrush generation, the people who lost out in the Windrush scandal because they weren't able to prove that they were British citizens. So my concern is that we could face another Windrush unless the government are more flexible about accepting late applications. Also, there are children who are in care who their rights, they would need somebody else to apply for their rights to be protected. So again, we don't want to see children sort of missing out in this situation either. So it was a very important issue, and that's why I was asking the question to hold the government to account.
Do you believe that the system should be more opt-out? So, for example, with organ donation in this country, the new law has been you're in the system unless you opt out. Do you think that that would have been a safer way to assure that a lot of EU citizens had their rights protected, and then if they didn't want to and wanted to move back to the continent, then the opt-out system would deliver this right to them?
I think some system of guaranteeing your rights, irrespective of when you apply for such status, would have been preferable. Whether the opt-in, opt-out model would have been the best one, I don't know. But I think certainly making sure that you don't lose those rights, that you have those rights, they're protected, is very important, because I think otherwise you could have serious unintended consequences as a result.
So, continuing your work in this May to June period, you've discussed at length and even visited asylum facilities. Has the government committed to making the improvements that you have called for?
Well, I've made one visit, and that was to a refugee and asylum support centre in Halifax. And it was a real joy to hear the views of the people that had been helped by the refugee asylum centre. But on a separate issue, there are facilities. There's asylum accommodation in Napier Barracks that I asked a question of the government about today, where the government didn't seem to follow the Public Health England guidelines. They didn't follow the guidelines about the about fire safety. There were serious concerns about COVID breaking out, and a COVID outbreak did happen at the barracks because people are in dormitory accommodation. So I think the government have got a lot to answer for, and I think we need to push them to hold them properly to account as to why they're not even complying with Public Health England and fire safety guidelines.
Is there a way to push this issue to hold them more to account?
Well, it's obviously they have a big majority, so it's harder in Parliament, but there are still rules in Parliament. And I know that this is an area that my friend and colleague Yvette Cooper has been pushing in the Home Affairs Select Committee. So I think it's something they're very keen to ask more questions about. But there was also a legal challenge. So the government were taken to court and they lost the case about the adequacy of the accommodation. But they still seem hell-bent on using the Napier Barracks to provide this accommodation for, it's first instance accommodation for asylum seekers. So they just seem hell-bent on doing that, and contrary to the advice. So we do need to do more to hold the government to account, and I'll certainly be pushing that as much as I can.
Bringing back the focus to your constituency, and crime figures were recently released, which showed that Enfield has the worst burglary rate in London, and one of the highest, actually, in the whole of the country. There were 2,351 recorded residential burglaries in Enfield in 2020, which equated to 18.25 burglaries per 1,000 households throughout the year. What is being done to help this problem, Bambos?
I think part of the problem is the we need to make sure that people are aware about how to better secure their properties. So I think there's an education aspect there. So it's about sort of closing, make sure doors are closed, windows are closed, making sure that people take the right precautions. At a time when everyone's been at home, it's been much harder for people to break into properties. But there are lots of people who, lots of criminals who would not have had many spoils from their criminal activity, who are obviously going to be looking for opportunities. So we need to be very vigilant. And I'd encourage people to find out, first of all, to make sure their homes are secure. Secondly, to contact the police for any advice, and to make sure they have neighbourhood watch groups so they can actually pass on intelligence. Many roads have WhatsApp groups that they share intelligence about anything that's going on in their road that might seem suspicious activity. So again, to share that information, secure your homes, look out for each other. But most of all, just to report things to the police, because the police rely on intelligence. And it might seem quite an innocuous thing, but if it's caused you concern, then it might be something that the police might have an interest in. So I think those three things are probably the way I would tackle it.
Another crime issue is that many local Uber drivers are reporting that they are receiving abuse from passengers over mask wearing. What advice do you give to concerned drivers, and is anything being done to help them?
Well, it's always a difficult situation, but ultimately the Uber drivers are the ones that have the power here, because they can just refuse to take them where they want to go. What they're doing is putting at risk the driver who's going about their own activity and trying to drive somebody home. If you're not wearing a mask, no matter how much you believe or what you believe about the coronavirus, you're still potentially putting somebody at risk in that confined space. So purely for safety reasons, people should wear masks and should obey the rules. So, I wear a mask when I go on the tube and on the train, and whenever I go shopping, and people, unless they're exempt, should follow the rules as well. So if I was an Uber driver, I would just refuse to take that fare if they weren't going to wear a mask in the back, unless they were exempted from doing so.
A local level, local government protection, what can be done there? Do you think that police can get involved and maybe advise and teach people that, you know, the area of the cab is actually belonging to the Uber driver, and at the end of the day, it's their domain. You have to respect it.
I don't think it's necessarily a police issue, because it's really down to the it's a health and safety issue. There was a court ruling earlier this year that said that Uber drivers were employees. So it's really an issue for their employer, for Uber, to make sure that they have an awareness campaign. They raise the issue, they publicize it. Maybe inside the vehicle there might be some notices that people know that they they won't be accepted if they don't wear a mask. But I think also Uber can they can rate passengers as well. So the drivers can rate the passenger once they've been, after they've picked them up. So I think if passengers get negative scores, then they might struggle to get lifts in the future. So that might be one way of dealing with the problem, if people are going to cause a nuisance in that way.
Okay, so really the onus relies on Uber then, rather than at a local or police level then?
I think so, yeah.
So this month, the Labour Council in Enfield has caused some controversy in the area by allowing a draft for 6,000 homes on Green Belt land. Bambos, how is this allowed when these areas are protected?
Well, it's a very good question. Local authorities are required by law to produce a plan. And this plan is a legal requirement by the government as to where the council, where developments can be. It doesn't mean it will be there, but it's where it can be. And what seems to be the case here is that Enfield have already allocated all their brownfield sites, but still they're being required by the government to provide more sites for housing. And so the only sites that would seem to be available would be sites in the Greenbelt. Now, I'm not a fan of development. I've opposed a number of applications. If there was an application in the Greenbelt, I'd probably oppose that as well. But I think there's a legal requirement to by the government for Enfield to come up with such a plan. So I think it's I think that's where it's come from. But let's be clear about this. We do need to have, there does need to be more housing being to be built somewhere. But we just need to be sensitive about where it is built, because I think that's going to be really important, because otherwise people won't be able to afford to live in London, and that will cause huge shortages in all our services. Also, one other thing that I discovered today was that Robert Jenrick, the Communities and Local Government Minister, has actually approved the building on the Greenbelt in Bradford. So it's coming from the government, and the government are the ones that are bringing forward an easing in planning laws, because they see building and development as a good thing. So that's coming directly from the government.
Well, on this issue of building and planning laws, do you think that it would be better to relax planning laws in areas where there are already houses and present, and to kind of use wasted land or wasted property that it might be disused or no longer functional? Because quite often developers or individuals who might just want to expand an area that they already own talk about how difficult it can be to get permission to do these things.
I think it has to be a balance, and I think that I think certainly if we can reuse existing sites, that's always going to be far better. But developers probably won't like that, because it's probably going to be more expensive for them to develop these areas. We've already heard about the government keen to allow former office blocks to be used for housing. So my preference would be for where there's existing housing for it to go in those locations. We have to have concern about the provision of local services, so health services, for instance, schools. So these are also, there'll be an impact on local services the more you develop. And obviously roads and public transport are another factor that needs to be taken into account. My preference would be for it to be developed in existing areas, but if not, then they have to be built somewhere if they have to be built at all.
So the final question from me before we move into the community questions, this was quite a fun one. you had a mini viral tweet this month with your photo of how you looked in the 1990s. Now, obviously, that's a little while ago now. But were you always into politics, and would young Bambos be proud of where your career has taken you thus far?
Yeah, I probably was always interested in politics. When I was a student at Liverpool, I was the vice president of the student union. So I did play a part in student politics on a local level in Liverpool. So I was always interested in that area. I'd probably been quite happy to, you know, if my younger self would have been pretty happy to see where I am now.
Well, that's good to hear, Bambos. Let's move it into the discussions from the local community, though. And as always, with these discussions, Radio Verulam is here to help the community, and we called for questions for you. You can always email me, jason.mckenna@radioverulam.co.uk, if you have questions for Bambos, who will be back next month. But Ian starts off the questions talking about, I think, one of the big things in the ether at the moment, and maybe it's overshadowing the Euros just a little bit, but he has asked, Bambos, do you support taking the knee at football matches? Do you agree those that oppose it generally have no real excuse and it just disguises their racism?
I do support taking the knee. I think racism is still, sadly, an issue. It's certainly an issue in football. If it's not directly on the terraces, then it's there via social media. Many of the black and minority ethnic players receive online abuse from particular platforms. I know Marcus Rashford gets a fair bit of abuse, and it shouldn't be allowed. And I think as long as there's racism, I think if football players think that it's a good way of demonstrating their opposition to racism, then they should take the knee, and I'd certainly be joining them.
So do you think that politics and sport should be hand in hand with one another? Because this is where some of the disagreement comes from.
Well, I think the issue is about racism, and I don't think it's, racism shouldn't be just a political issue. I think racism is racism, and I don't think anybody in a civilized society would want to see racism, but sadly it exists. So until we've eradicated racism, then people should have the right to protest in such a way.
Louise wants to talk about e-scooters. She says, why have they been allowed in London when we were told that they were dangerous? And if I was to ride one, then it would be taken off me.
I agree with Louise. I think e-scooters are dangerous. They're not meant to be driven on the public highway, but they are doing some trials in five London boroughs where you have to hire them. And I think there are various controls about them, but they are dangerous, particularly for if you're a disabled person and you can't hear a scooter. So I think we need to be quite careful, and there will need to be some sort of regulation as to where and how you can drive an e-scooter. At the moment, they should only be driven on private land and not on public spaces. But I see many of them being driven on roads and on pavements where they clearly shouldn't be. So I do have, I share Louise's concerns. But let's see how the experiments go in London, and that might give us a clue as to where we end up with regulation of the e-scooters.
Would you oppose a pilot scheme if it was offered to Enfield and Southgate?
I wouldn't oppose it, because I think you can still learn from them. Having a pilot scheme would still allow you some degree of control, but I'd want to see what the results of the scheme were. But they're quite clearly people who are just flouting the law. And I do think that they're endangering themselves and other people by doing so.
Would you ever ride one yourself, Bambos?
Never say never, but but I would only do so in a lawful way.
Yes, of course. Andy has said, you seem to be concentrating a lot of effort on Mika Slot's business. What progress has been done, and do you think it's fair to single out a totally legitimate business?
Well, this is an issue that I've had a huge amount of communication from my local constituents. And it's something that they're very unhappy about, because I think they think that having an adult gaming centre where people could lose a significant amount of money and could be open 24 hours is not the sort of thing we want to see on our high street. I share those concerns. The application has been is being reviewed by Enfield Council. It's being reviewed next Wednesday. So hopefully we'll see whether the licence will be allowed to go ahead or not. But clearly there are concerns about what impact that will have on the high street, particularly in relation to concerns about antisocial behaviour and potentially crime. But we'll see.
Would you say then that your vigour, as Andy is asking about, is due to the fact that you're representing your constituents' views? This isn't just a project that you yourself are singly passionate about.
Obviously, it is something that my views are entirely in accord with my constituents. So I do have concerns, because if we want to regenerate the high street, we need to get the right balance of shops and offer on the high street. And I don't think that what Mika Slots are offering is particularly desirable or helpful in the regeneration of the high street. I mean, they are a legitimate business, but you know, they would have to face up to the challenges. And one of the challenges is to get their application through.
Antonia has highlighted something that seems to have upset her this month. She said, I saw in the mail this month, not that I ever read it, a headline that was incredibly offensive and wrong. It said that British towns are a no-go area for white people and that families live under Taliban-like rules. She says, how can such lies be allowed to be spreading race hate in this country? Why is it not illegal?
Well, I entirely agree with her. I saw the article that she's referring about. I think people thought it was laughable, thought it was a joke at first. It was spoof. I think where people feel that they can complain, I think if the complaints are made, particularly to the if they've caused offence, then people should certainly complain about it and make sure that the people who write it are held to account. So there are various complaints mechanisms, certainly writing to the local paper, but also if it's a more serious issue to any press sort of complaints bodies would be a good way forward.
Realistically though, Bambos, are the rules stringent enough on discussions like this? Because you quite often hear about them or other such organisations publishing things that do not have any truth behind them, and there doesn't seem to be any sort of comeback for them.
I think we do need to have a free press. The press should be able to print what they think is free and accurate. They should be free to criticise people. But where they get it wrong, they should also apologise and they should clarify the mistakes that they make. So I think that having some mechanism whereby these issues can be resolved and not just swept under the carpet would be very, very helpful. I do think that the press need to behave in a very responsible manner. Doesn't mean that they shouldn't criticize people, but they should certainly put right things that are inaccurate or wrong or misleading.
Michael has moved the conversation back to something a little bit more local. He's asked, why have Tottenham Hotspur been allowed to use the old White Webb's golf course instead of allowing it to be used by local people again? It seems unfair that another local community valuable asset has been lost.
Well, again, this is a very good question. I mean, White Webb is actually in Ferrell's constituency, not mine. But on to try and deal with the issue that he's raised... I think the council are concerned about making money from their assets. They're in a dire financial situation. Many councils are. We've seen a number of councils having to be bailed out by the government because of their difficult financial situation. So I think all Enfield are looking to do is to try and make as much money as they can out of their assets, which will go back into public services. My understanding is that Spurs are just one of a number of bidders for the White website. So I don't think it's a fait accompli that they'll definitely get it. I mean, clearly it was a golf course and people were able to enjoy the golf course because it was a public golf course. So I don't know what the ins and outs of Spurs' proposal is, but I do think that the public should be able to use public assets wherever possible. So I'd be interested to see what Spurs are proposing.
Do these situations make you feel a bit uncomfortable? Because this is obviously a Labour council almost removing a public asset. Or is this because of the dire financial situation that they don't really have a choice?
I think where the council does have public assets, then they should certainly, in my view, where possible, remain public. And I think there's no question about this being sold off. I think the question is about the use of the land. Again, I don't know what Spurs are planning to do with the use of the land, but I do think that there has to be some sort of community benefit as a result of anything that happens there. So again, I don't know too much about it, but I think the community has to benefit in the long run. But councils are being forced to go down this path. They're being sort of put in a very difficult situation. And I don't think it will be their first choice to do this, but I think councils are being forced to look at more unpalatable options just to make the books balance.
Where does the help need to come from then to balance these books? Is it central government's fault, or was it the council's fault to be able to bring in more money?
Well, I think certainly the government have cut local authorities' budgets by over half in the last 10, 11 years. So, you know, if you had half your income, you'd have to make sort of serious sacrifices. Obviously, the councils should be able to, should have the freedoms to do things. But, you know, you have to be very careful with the council. You can only sort of increase things by so much before people start getting very annoyed. And so it's a real balancing act. You can't increase things too much. Otherwise, well, it will just... you'll have a rebellion on your hands if you do that too much. So it's kind of it's a very fine balance that you've got to strike.
June has moved the conversation on to the issues around President Joe Biden. She's asked, do you think it's right for the US president to comment on the Brexit and Northern Ireland situation? If we were to talk in a similar way to the Americans would laugh at us.
Well, I think we have to be clear that the Good Friday Agreement was brokered with the help of the US. So it's obviously of keen interest. There's a long history of Irish migration to America. So I think I think that's why there is such keen interest with the US and what's going on in Northern Ireland and Ireland. And I think they want to make sure that we don't see a return to violence on the streets of Northern Ireland, which is a real danger if there's a hard border, but try and help find a solution. So much time and effort was invested in bringing about the Good Friday Agreement, not just by Tony Blair, but also John Major, and obviously the politicians from Northern Ireland and the Republic who put a huge amount of time and effort, and it was helped in part by America. So they have a vested interest in this. And I think if they can bring about a helpful solution, that will be in everyone's benefit.
So moving on to Mary's question, and she's discussing about Matt Hancock. She explains that he broke the ministerial code in a minor way. Is crime now going to be judged as to how much the law has been broken rather than a black and white of whether rules were or were not adhered to. She adds, if I was doing 31 in a 30 mile per hour zone, surely this is a minor and technical breach of the law, kind of using the language that was used by Matt Hancock and the government. I mean, what is your opinion on this ban, boss?
Well, I think if, you know, obviously there are degrees of breaching the ministerial code, but I think in the past, if you breached the ministerial code, it was a resigning matter. And it's quite galling that you see more and more ministers who seem to flout this rule. So I have deep concerns about why there isn't more pressure, why it seems to be something that they can just brush off. But as I was saying earlier, it's up to the press and the public to hold the politicians to account. If they've breached the rules, you know, you can't have one rule for us and one rule for them. It's got to be, you have to follow the rules. And she's right to make that analogy. You know, it's not right that, you know, you as a member of the public get penalised for breaking the law, and if you're a minister, you get away with it. But sadly, we're in a situation where breaking the rule seems to have no consequence if you're a minister, which is very, very disappointing.
The fair question to ask you, Bambos, is if you were Prime Minister, or at least in charge of the situation, and a similar situation happened under you with a minister, would you call for them to be resigning?
Well, I'd have to look at all the facts, but if they had breached the ministerial code and it was quite unclear and that they'd done so, then it certainly would be a resigning issue.
You're saying there with the ministerial code, it is how it was broken, but surely if you do break the ministerial code in any situation, surely that is a resignation kind of matter. Surely it shouldn't matter about the context.
The only thing I could say is that if it was, sometimes it's inadvertent, and there might be some wriggle room there if it's inadvertent, but it depends on the facts. As you know, you'd have to look at sort of what the breach was. If it was like completely flouting the laws and you know having disregard for them, then yeah, of course they should go. If it was something that you were late submitting a form or something, then that might be slightly different, and maybe you should have like a, I don't know if they have written warnings for ministers, but they should have like, you know, maybe a final written warning if that was the case. But you've got to abide by the rules, and it's not even that he didn't resign. It's just there was no consequence of this. There's enough, nothing's happened to him. He's, you know, it's just become a short story that is forgotten about the next day, and that's not acceptable.
Do you think then, if Labour were to come to power, that these sorts of rules would be toughened up? Is this something that you'd be very much keen on overseeing?
I don't think being toughened up. I think it's applying the rules. I think they're not being applied properly. So I think that's where more needs to be done to ensure that people are complying with the rules. The rules are there, and you need to make sure that they're complied with. So I think having more of it's a cultural thing as well. You need to make sure that the culture is, these are the rules, we have to follow them, and not allowing people to wriggle out of them, as Matt Hancock seems to have done here.
So let's move it on to finish on something hopefully that will be really happy and positive. It is Euro 2020 / Euro 21, however you want to label it. But football is starting soon. In fact, very soon, when we're doing this interview, it will be on the Friday. There's going to be many games, but the final and lots of other games are going to be here in the UK. First of all, will you try and attend? But if not, how will you be watching the Three Lions play?
Well, I'd love to attend, but I think because we've got such a limited number of tickets, it will be quite a popular gig. If I can, I'd love to. If I can, I'll try and watch it in a pub. That's how I usually like to watch it if possible. But it depends again if the pubs are open and what the rule, you know, well, they will be open, but what the rules are about sort of watching games, because I don't know if things will change, but that would be my preferred option. Seeing how the Euros unfold. There'll be some very interesting games there. Obviously, England have got Croatia on Sunday, so that'll be a repeat of the semi-final, which were, well, I thought England would walk that and get to the final of the World Cup, but that wasn't the case. And obviously England will then play Scotland, so, you know, that'll be a very interesting game as well. I think England have got a good team. They've got a really good chance of progressing. I think their only weaknesses is in defence, but other than that, they've got a very strong team, and I wish them all the very best, and also Wales and Scotland as well, and I hope they progress too.
Will football be coming home, Bambos?
Well, football's definitely coming home.
I mean, the final question that I have to ask you, obviously we're a radio station here, so do you have a favourite England song?
The Badil Skinner Lightning Seeds one, Football's Coming Home, is a popular chant. But yeah, so I think that's probably my favourite sort of England song. But yeah, I think that one, it just reminds me of Euro 96, and it was such an amazing tournament. Very, very sad to go out to Germany in the semi-finals in that one. But it was such a buzz around the country when that was going on, and it was the time of Britpop. It takes me back to my younger days, so I have very fond memories of that song.
I mean, the funny thing for you, Bambos, is there'll be cross-party agreement, because Bim Afolabi actually said the same song is his favourite England song. So Labour and Conservatives unite there in terms of the greatest English song of all time. But as always, it has been great to talk to you and get the questions answered for the community, Bambos. Again, just reminding people, if you've not had them answered this time around, do not worry. Bambos will be back again next month. But Bambos, thank you so, so much for chatting today, and we look forward to chatting to you again next month.
Thank you, Jason. Look forward to it.